now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to The Ruck. Today is Beer Garden Monday and you're invited to listen to this podcast sitting outside a pub, freezing to death, attempting to warm yourself over the ashes of English clubs in the Heineken Cup. As we record this podcast, there is snow falling outside my palatial London home. Actually, there is major good news though. The shops are open and Jonesy can finally get a haircut. Even better, as we've recruited to the podcast today one of the all-time specialists in French rugby. Everything good in rugby at the moment is French. They could even lay on two of the most dismal quarterfinals of all time yesterday and still get three teams in the semi-finals. To explain all, we have the brilliant Martin Gillingham, TV commentator and specialist on the top 14. Martin, great to have you back again. You're on mute.
The great commentator. Martin, you're on mute.
Great to have the mute Martin back on.
Greetings. It's great to be here.
Hey, well, how long have you been a commentator,
No, Stephen, you must learn in this business of commentating. Know how to use silence.
You mean when you've accidentally muted yourself?
All those periods of silence in Martin's French top 14 game to when he's got his mute button on. Great
Some
start.
Of your best work, Martin.
You might just have then heard the voice of the great Chris Jones. Who was in Bedford for us yesterday. No, you weren't.
I could have gone to Bedford, but I probably made a better choice in going to Saracens, where the game was. But I could have gone to Bedford and got a sort of a pulse of how they felt of being mullered by the entire England contingent minus Farrell.
Yeah, OK. Well done for going to Saracens, not Bedford. That shows a great professional ability there. I didn't introduce myself, though. I'm Owen Slott. Maybe you recognise this voice after 27 years of doing this bloody podcast. Jonesy, you're here as well to make us all behave, I suggest.
And also, I had a haircut last week through my daughter, so don't say I'm going to have my haircut, long-awaited haircut, because the fans out there can't see me, but I have got very short hair. The other thing is, where's the old baldy bloke? That baldy bloke, he's not here.
He spent the whole day doing TV yesterday.
Does that mean we can say what we want this week?
Go on, let it go then.
Oh, well, we can talk about Wasps, we can talk about Saracens, all the things Lawrence comes hand at. All right, I missed his intro, be fair.
Well, hopefully you'll be back next week and we can get things back to normal.
All right, okay.
Let's talk about Europe first. And does the fact there's no English clubs in the semi-finals, should that be a concern to English rugby? Is it a state of the nation thing, or in my opinion, it's just slightly the thing things didn't work out this year.
No, that's absolutely right. And look, everything's different in the time of COVID. Things didn't work out. I mean, because of the lack of a proper pool section, things didn't come out. You know, not necessarily the top teams came through, and some teams met stronger teams in the quarterfinals than they might have expected. No, it's not. I mean, Exeter would just had one of those games, and it is one of those games where they weren't there. They weren't up to it. They tried their best, but things just didn't happen for them. I think we always say whoever wins the Heineken European Cup, if it's an English team, we always say, oh, the Ireland teams have had it and vice versa. It's not a long-term problem, I don't think. It was a bizarre weekend, but the reports of the death of English club rugby would have been exaggerated.
Yeah. So on the other side of that, Martin, you've been watching the development of the top 14. There is an argument for embracing the fact they've got three sides in the semi-finals and saying, well, that's the product of long-term development and this is the great surge of the French clubs. I think there's probably more in that than saying that it's the death of the English clubs.
Well, I think that a pertinent point here is if we go back a year, the French were the first to knock their domestic season on the head and say, right, what we're going to do is write it off. We're going to come back in August, September. They had a long off season, perhaps too long, you could argue, but certainly time to prepare. And just chatting with a lot of players, and I'm not talking here about the, you know, the England players, the international players, who the Saracens players have been getting lots of time off throughout this season. But the guys who are at the work base week in, week out, just had 9 straight weeks of Gallagher Premiership rugby. I think that the English teams are suffering quite a bit from the fact that we came back, we finished the end of season. Many of these players have been playing, if not week after week after week, but they've had an incredibly long season. And we're almost reversing roles. I mean, we used to say sometimes the French sides don't all, with the exceptions of the likes of Clermont and Toulouse, chuck everything at Europe because simply their season is too long. In this respect, the roles are reversed. We've now got French players who are far fresher than they have been in past seasons, and the English who are not. And I think, you know, the other key point when we analyse the form of the English sides, we haven't got Saracens there at the moment. And if we go back over the last few seasons, certainly in the Premier competition, the Heineken Champions Cup, it has been Exeter and it's been Saracens. And I know we've seen the emergence of Bristol, but the reality is we've got a French season which has allowed players to be much fresher, an English season which has been a bit more like a French season in the past, and we've had, in terms of, you know, proven animals at European level, half the number competing from England.
Chris, I look at the English demise in inverted commas, if you like, and I'm thinking in the past, as Martin said, the Premiership kind of relied on Saracens to lead the way, and now sort of Exeter have sort of reached that level too. So when Saracens are back, you would say, oh, well, there's probably 2 clubs up at that level who could contend. I don't know what you think, but I would say that probably Bristol are there or will be there pretty soon. They're certainly on the way, and maybe arguably Sale as well. So, I mean, do you think that maybe this time in a year, well, Saracens won't be playing in a year, but do you think we got that England do have sort of 4 teams or more that would be fit for purpose?
They're certainly coming on slowly, but what's interesting is, you know, is Exeter as champions came up against a Leinster side who, with their vast European experience, knew how to win. When they were in trouble, they didn't panic and they got themselves into a position to win. And, you know, Sale, you know, were pretty close, you know, heading towards half time against La Rochelle, but they didn't have that ability then to step it up that next level. And I think it's a learning curve for teams like Sale. And, you know, under Alex Sanderson, they are going to learn very quickly. He'll bring a lot of that Saracens nous to them. But they're not ready yet, I don't think, in terms of experience. But teams, you know, like Leinster, you just look at the way that there are changes in their team, but they don't panic because they know, they understand what it takes to win in Europe. And I think that's why we're not seeing, you know, teams coming through at the moment from England, because they don't have that experience without Saracens being there. I mean, Saracens' European experience has been used in the Championship to what effect, we could ask. But no, I don't. I put big thumbs up to those teams that have been learning to win in Europe, and some of the England teams are just starting.
I remember when Martin Johnson was team manager of England, he always said that it was vitally important that England had 4 really great top-grade clubs at the top of the table, very important for the England team, and that they were competitive in Europe, etc. And the teams you brought up, I think, have got a decent chance. I think Bristol next year, Bristol target one thing at a time. I think next year they'll target Europe. Pat Lam will recruit to that aim. So I think, and then Sale have got massive potential. So next year we could just be at a stage where there are 4 genuine contenders. And I mean genuine contenders, not just someone making up the bottom 4, the top 4. So I think you make a good point. And I think there's a chance next year.
There are the 2 English clubs in the Challenge Cup, you know, semis, and Leicester are, you know, a great European name. They're starting to put together a horrible pack again, and Bath, you know, with what they've got, they, you know, they could compete with anybody on the day. And, you know, Montpellier haven't had a fantastic season, as Martin knows, but they've put together 5 wins in a row. So the Challenge Cup matches are well worth watching as well, because you've also got Ulster in there, who were just, you know, they were just Ulster at Northampton, weren't they? They weren't going to lose that match. And yeah, there's some good rugby going around. It does include a couple of English clubs.
And when you say good rugby, that's not what you'd have said, Martin, of the two all French affairs in the quarterfinals yesterday. So we've spent so long drooling about, you know, the French are back and they've actually remembered how to play French rugby again. So how do you explain what happened yesterday?
I explain it by turning the clock back maybe 5 to 10 years, and I watched playoff match, the barrage, as they call them in France, so sort of half quarterfinals and then the semi-finals.
Sorry, can you just say that again in your French accent? Because
barrage.
We're just purring.
I'm bringing something to you this morning. We used to watch utter rubbish week after week with these playoff matches, and it is just simply one of those classic occasions where the occasion beats everyone, and I think that was the case yesterday. It was almost like turning the clock back to a top 14 semi-final weekend from 5 or 10 years ago, when you would get one decent match every two or three seasons. And I think it's as simple as that, really. I mean, we saw the best of France, didn't we, in the second 40 at the Marcel de Flandre, where, for half an hour in the first half, La Rochelle was sort of shadow boxing almost with Sale. I think there was a slightly odd decision made between referee and TMO, whatever it was, 10 minutes or so before half time, when Dylan Lade scored that try, and that sparked a bit of life from both sides. But then in the second half, it was just all one way traffic. And I think we saw what we tend to associate with French rugby. But I do feel that what we saw on Sunday was entirely reflective of what we often see from French sides in knockout matches in the top 14.
Racing, they have to win something big because of the way they're set up and their eminence and the money they spend. Clermont and Racing had a brilliant chance. Clermont had a chance to really go all the way. Now, the week before, they were absolutely devastating against Wasp. They played so rapidly with so much skill and so much power. And Racing, similarly, against Edinburgh. And I totally get what you say about the barrage. Barrage.
Come on, get it right, Jonesy.
If I was a fan, I'd give them a barrage of abuse. Because when it comes down to it, I mean, whatever you're out there for, when you suddenly start trailing with 10 minutes to go, surely you've got to play. And I cannot believe how supine Clermont and Racing really were. And even, you know, when are you going to go out of the competition? I totally get what you're saying, Mark, but suddenly someone had to play and they didn't. And I just thought, blimey, you know, yesterday I was going to sit down and really enjoy those two games. At the end, I was so sort of bored. I had the awful experience of watching Spurs. So it was a bizarre afternoon for me.
Yeah, well, I disappeared off to the golf course before the end of the afternoon, which I thought was the better option. But I agree. I mean, it's absolutely frustrating when you see what happened in that cracking match in Coventry, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, to then have to face up to this. But hey, c'est la vie.
Martin, can I ask you about the fact that both the French matches were refereed by English referees, and in the Bordeaux Racing game, there was 30 penalties by Matthew Carley and a couple of yellow cards. Do you think it's a case maybe of them being refereed an English way, and they were just technically a bit, well, some of them were ridiculous penalties, blocking the guy trying to catch the ball from the kickoff, and the breakdown was all kinds of sort of technical problems. Is that a factor, Martin, do you think?
No, I think it is. And I think that also, again, if we flip it around, we've seen a lot of frustration, haven't we, with French referees refereeing sides from our side of La Manche.
Oh, lovely. Do you need me to translate for you there, Chris?
I've lost it a bit. Are we on French television now?
You can get simultaneous translation if you're downloading this podcast.
Brilliant. Honestly, he's added, fair play to Gillers, he's added a touch of class.
Hey, I'm bringing some Afrikaans. We've got to talk about the Lions tour.
Oh, blimey, yeah. He's multilingual now.
Martin, just Clermont, they appear to be a team that have crested the wave and might be crashing down the other side without actually ever having remembered to win the Heineken Cup. You know, they've been built around Parra and Lopez and a number of old stages, Fritz Lee, and they're not going to carry on going. Are they refreshing? Have they got some? Have they got a new generation who will take over, or is that it for a few years?
I think there is an element of that. And I mean, there's a there's a danger reading too much into individual circumstances, but let's look. Frank Azema, after a decade away at the club, is leaving. Now, my first instinct was, is he going because he's got this big offer from Montpellier and we know how much money that Moed Altra has got? But I was speaking to someone at the weekend who knows the Clermont club inside out, and I get the impression that not all is as well as it might be. Frank Azema is moving on, not necessarily because there's a bigger paycheck, not necessarily because it needs another challenge, but because maybe things are not quite as he would like them to be at Clermont. So, I mean, maybe there's a suggestion there that, again, I mean, they were our guilty pleasure, weren't they, for 10 years, our favourite second team. Maybe, I don't know, we have to review that and think, well, maybe not all is quite as well there in volcano country as we'd like to think it, or as it was maybe 5 to 10 years ago.
If they're not going to be our favourite second team, Jonesy, then surely we've all got to pile in for La Rochelle in a few weekends on the Atlantic coast.
Definitely. I think it's great that there's someone there from outside the normal geographical location. And good luck to them. Do you know that there were U-boat pens there in the Warsaw Tee?
Well, I've heard that, but I wasn't there myself. Were you in that campaign?
I was there. I was in the Secret Service at the time.
And you know the history of Marcel de Flandre. It's good that Jonesy talks about that. Because if we talk about true fortresses in European rugby, Marcel de Flandre was the club president during the war. Now, he was doing that job by day, and by night, he was sitting there in the harbour watching the U-boats come in and out. I mean, he literally died for the city because he was a key figure in the French resistance and was shot by the Nazis.
Blimey.
God.
You didn't know that, did you?
I'm writing all this down, you know. I'm thinking of doing a book.
Well, he's more interesting than Lawrence Martin, isn't he? That's a great story.
And he did it in English as well, which helps for some of our listeners.
Yeah.
Soddy, can you tell Lawrence he's not coming back? Give him a ring.
He's got to come up with a story to match that every week from now.
Exactly. That's a cracker.
Martin, is it right to have a huge love-in with Ronan O'Gara and Jono at La Rochelle? I mean, I've enjoyed what they've been doing. I thought what they did in the second half against Sale was pretty impressive in the way that they suddenly broaden their game out and were really effective in attack, having done the hard bit up front with those gigantic forwards.
Yes, I think it is, Chris. And I think that they are our Clermont, if you like. I mean, the cruel irony, of course, is that the clever money is on Jono Gibbs being poached by Clermont to return there as replacement for Frank Azema. So, I mean, that's good old. I mean, it's like EastEnders sometimes, isn't it, French rugby? But that's the thing that's supposed to be happening, which is a bit of a shame. But you're right. I mean, it's a cracking lineup, isn't it, for this semi-final? I mean, you could make it up with Roland Agara up against Leinster.
If you had the clever money, Jonesy, when would you have Ronan O'Gara returning to Irish rugby? Because that seems to be a narrative that's forewritten, isn't it?
It does. I have to say that I really admire the bloke for the way he's done it. He's gone out for looked around all the cultures and played in different cultures and coached in different divisions around the world. I really, really admire that. These days, we have this term super coach, and that means you've got a gun, as did Graham Henry, for instance, gone to other places to coach, rather than just coming up the same boring system. Sorry, not knocking Irish coaches, but they're coming up the same way where everyone thinks the same. Now, you've got Ronan O'Gara, who's already thinking out of the box. I mean, he's bound to come in unless someone really wants a very, very fine coach and they give him a lot of money not to go to Ireland. I just think he's done brilliantly. Looking forward to him coming back. I mean, I'm sure he will go to Ireland and take over from Andrew Farrell.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chris, can we just talk about your trip that you didn't make to Bedford yesterday, the one to North London? So you saw Saracens beat Bedford by 40-odd points?
Half century, mate. And just to say that the ground there is being rebuilt. It's a very strange vista, but just like the team, you know, by next year, it will be a really impressive ground. And they will have their status back, you would expect. Otherwise, that ground ain't going to be used for anything, because if they don't get up, we know what that means for their players and for the finances of the club. But Nigel Ray was there yesterday surveying his empire, and you know, he's still in there helping the club financially. And as long as he is doing that, they will have the ability to put out the sort of team that we saw taking on Bedford, who... you would have almost expected them to have their autograph books ready at the end of the game to go around the Saracens players, because all the big names are there, minus Owen Farrell, whose calf injury is probably going to clear up by the time they play unbeaten Doncaster away on Saturday. So, it's interesting to see a front row of Macavunapola, Jamie George and Vincent Koch up against Bedford. And boy, did they muller the scrum. And that just shows you, the sort of, Martin's talked before about, what players are not in Europe at the moment. There were some big players on show against Bedford yesterday.
This allows us to utter sentences that you wouldn't normally expect to appear on anywhere, let alone a highly rated podcast like this. But Saracens have two big games coming up now against Doncaster and Ealing Trailfinders.
The two unbeaten teams. And, Mark McCaw was very clear yesterday that his England players, and obviously Scotland with Sean Maitland playing well on the wing, will be on duty, firstly at Doncaster, and then against the massive game against Ealing Trailfinders, who, as we all remember, beat them twice in pre-season warm-up matches. And, Mark keeps on going on about the fact that the Ealing Trailfinders are a settled squad and they've been around a long time and know how to win in a championship. But he's got British Irish Lions players all over his team, and if you can't beat Doncaster and Trailfinders, you certainly don't deserve to be back in the Premiership.
So the chance of an upset don't really exist then, Jonesy. What do you think?
Well, I think the Trailfinders are a lot better than people think. I really do. I think they're a terrific club and they've done exceptionally well. So can I just make one other point? We knew that Saracens, when they came into the division, would boost things. I think this year the Championship's got more coverage than it had for the last like four or five seasons put together. And I think that the Cornish Pirates, Doncaster, Ealing, Bedford, Coventry, not only have they cashed in on the Saracens effect, but I think they've come to life as a set of clubs. And I think that it is high time that the RFU went back to their shocking decision and re-established the Championship, because these guys have come through so well after lockdown with no crowds, no money, that their heartbeat is still there, as we knew when we went to Cornish Pirates. And I think the division is galvanised, partly by Saracens and partly by the fact that these clubs are strong and they've got a history and they've got roots. They should find ways of boosting the Championship more and carrying on and making it bloody good. And as I say, it's got more coverage this season than the previous five seasons put together.
Yeah, well, let me just ask your view on that, Jonesy. This is one of these subjects that could normally divert us for about 25 minutes. But I agree with pretty much everything you said, but I just think the problem with the Championship is it's effectively two divisions in itself. You've got like five professional teams and then another seven or something. I've looked, checked recently, but I think it's five and seven. You've got another seven who who has said, listen, we can't afford to do it that way. You've got two very different approaches, and they should really move apart in that respect if no one can help fund the whole thing.
That is a problem. I see what you're getting at, but I still very definitively think that if you did fund it properly or retain some of the funding, if you did a better TV deal, no one's ever bothered with a TV deal for it. You're just making it clubs more attractive, and the more attractive they are, the more likelihood they are to get local sponsors, maybe even national sponsors. So at the moment, there are clubs that are amateurish as well as amateur towards the bottom, but the whole club and the whole division rises if it continues on the same rate. And it is myopic of the RFU not to realise it. So there will be casualties. You're dead right. Some teams don't want to go up, but they can still be a gate-taking community club in the Championship.
And Jonesy, if I can just have a quick chirp, France. Look at that. They've got Pro de Deux, which falls under the LNR, who run the top 14. The second division in France has got a TV deal. It means that the gap between the top league and the second league is not a particularly wide one. It means there is genuine relegation and promotion. I know life is never quite as simple as that, because the economy in France, certainly where rugby is concerned, is different to ours. But, I mean, they've got it right there, haven't they?
Totally. And LNR, I just got so much admiration for them and the way they do things. And basically, you've got the LNR who are dominating the scene and giving the whole two divisions and maybe even the third division proper town-based club rugby. And you've got Premiership rugby who couldn't run a in a brewery.
Right. Boys, let's move on and talk about the Lions. So, I don't know, some people, when they listen to this podcast, if they're listening to it from Tuesday afternoon, will probably know the outcome to this conversation. But the Lions are due, this is Monday morning as we speak, the Lions are due to announce tomorrow who their coaching panel is. Now, our favourite Alex Lowe on Friday night, Saturday morning's newspapers broke the news that Warren Gatland's three of his top coaching choices had all withdrawn late from the coaching panel. So there's no Andy Farrell, no Steve Borthwick, and no Graham Rowntree, who were all fixtures from the previous Lions tour. So a unit that was proven and worked well together. Gatland's had to do some pretty quick work to replace them. Jonesy, how serious a problem do you think this is for the team?
Yes, it is, because the reason why that party has been together so long on so many Lions tours, and as we well know, is that it is a totally different challenge. It's almost an instant pop-up coaching challenge with the Lions because of the scandalously little preparation time they get. So you need people who are used to cutting the same corners. And first of all, I'm very, very rather suspicious that all three departed almost simultaneously. And it worries me that Gregor Townsend is obviously an excellent coach. He'll be fine. But it worries me that there was a lot of experience there, and a lot of experience at the shortcuts of a Lions tour. I think it's been a depressing weekend for the Lions and for the South Africans, because the Rainbow Cup has been canned, and it's a poor day for the Lions coaches. It's very poor that Warren's had to rush out suddenly and you know, make a few phone calls just to get his squad together.
I can understand that Andy Farrell withdrew late because he was waiting to see if there was an Ireland tour or not. And I respect that his priority was to go with Ireland. So that's why he couldn't go. I get also why Graham Rowntree's not travelling, because he has been in Ireland away from his family for an entire year. And he thought they were going to be able to travel on the tour with him as well. So I get that as well. I can't quite work out why Steve Borthwick would have pulled out, because he's known the dates and the details for a long time.
The fact is that Steve is absolutely committed to Leicester. I mean, you know what he's like. He's obsessive about everything. But, you know, just talking to him after the game, you know, he wouldn't talk about the Lions, because he said, I'm prepared to talk all year about Leicester. And that's it. He's Mr. Leicester now. And, you know, it's a massive loss to the Lions. As Ben Youngs was saying the week before, you know, this guy is considered by the players to be the best forwards coach in the world. And you know, as Steve mentioned, you're losing coaches who understand how to short circuit that building a Lions squad. And that's my real concern for this now going forward is, okay, you've got Neil Jenkins in and you've got Gatland as well. But you know, you're missing the guys who Gats was able to basically not have to say a lot of what needs to be said at the start of a Lions tour. Now he's got to go through it all with new people. And okay, Greg has been there as a player, but it's not like being part of that coaching unit that was so tight for the last couple of tours. And I'm really concerned about this because, you know, the whole Lions question has been up in the air for so many months. And now you have the rug pulled from underneath Gatland in terms of coaching, you know, and then you've got the possibility, and I'm sure Martin will talk about this, about the joys of possibly spending 7 or 8 weeks in the same hotel room in Johannesburg. Now, that really does make you want a tour, doesn't it?
I mean, that's absolutely the point, Chris. I think that they've been reading your stories, Slotty. And the prospect of being stuck in the middle of a Joburg Pretoria winter, which is not the most hospitable part of the world if you are a visitor, against the prospect of at least spending 3 weeks down there in Constantia on the wine farm and looking at the mountain, it suddenly is no longer quite the appealing prospect that maybe it was at the start of the year.
Well spoken by a man who's done his time down there. So, Martin, you had a nice pad in Constantia, did you?
Just down the road, actually. I couldn't quite afford Constantia. I stayed in a suburb called Tokaj. It's just on the other side of Hut Constantia and Klein Constantia and all those lovely wine farms.
Mm. Jones, are you worried about how this Lions tour is going to be? Because it's not going to be a tour, is it? It's going to be, as Martin said, a long stint in a hotel somewhere.
I can't get a definitive view on the actual COVID situation there. Martin would know that better than me, Owen. But I have to say now, I'm very, very concerned indeed. First of all, that these coaches have withdrawn. Secondly, it could be a kind of grim experience in one of the world's greatest touring venues. But also, the some coaches have dropped out. I think what we're now beginning to think is all our teams we pick, this is my 35 Lions, this is my Lions squad, do we know that all the players would definitely go as well? Some of them have got families, some of them maybe have underlying issues, health issues. You know, maybe Gatland's going to have to sort of scramble around to get 30-odd players to go there. Mm-hmm. And without raking over old coals, it would always remain the disgrace of 170 years' history of the Lions that this tour was not put back 1 year. I've never heard a single reason why it would not have been. And it's the old death riders in the unions and premiership rugby who stopped it, as well as possibly the other down under union. So it's a shocker. I'm very anxious about it. And the idea that the players of both sides should just be stuck in a hotel with hardly poking their noses out the door is very depressing.
The stories that have been coming out over the course of the last 48 hours about the Rainbow Cup, I mean, that's, if it doesn't happen, it's not happening because we don't want them over here because of the risk that might run. However, the irony is, as things stand, we're quite happy to send our lot over there. And in South Africa at the moment, there is no meaningful vaccination program at all. Mm-hmm. They've secured the vaccinations, but they have no infrastructure in which to distribute them. And there are challenges there because many people who will be listening to this associate South Africa with big cities and Cape Town and the mountain. But the reality is that South Africa is parts of the Eastern Cape. It's a northwest province. It is places that have no real infrastructure at all. So they're facing massive challenges.
You make a point about that European nations don't particularly fancy big numbers of South African sportsmen coming over here right now, Martin. But no one's actually been able to say for sure whether Lions from Britain and Ireland, when they return from their Lions trip in August, will they be asked to quarantine? There's no definitive on that at all either. Goes back to what you're saying, Steve, is will players be jumping at the invitation to tour with the Lions this year?
Yeah, I mean, that will become, I guess, the debate once we've got them over there. At the moment, we're debating, should we be going over there? And then once that's started, and maybe we have got them in South Africa, then we'll start writing the stories and discussing, well, should we be letting them back and straight onto our streets?
There is the also other aspect of this, is that the key South African players already in Europe, who then would have to go back and come back again. I mean, putting them in a very difficult situation. I mean, let alone as Rainbow Cup doesn't take place, but yeah, fine. When are these guys going to go back for any squad sessions? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Springboks coming off a standing start against the Lions. I mean, this is the ultimate standing start, isn't it?
They haven't played Test rugby since the World Cup final. We do have to keep on reminding ourselves.
Mm. But mind you, nor are the Lions. In fact, they haven't played Test rugby for quite a lot longer. So poor old them, huh?
Smarty pants.
Sound from the man in charge of the pod. Sound our reasoning. Thank you so much, Slotty.
I'm always upbeat about the Lions because they are essentially an upbeat thing, but they've been savaged by useless administration. Their own is hopeless. Anyone heard anything from Jason Leonard about it? He's meant to be the chairman, for God's sake. I'm afraid that I'm very, very depressed, and I would now bet on the fact that the tour does not go ahead.
Serious? You don't think it will happen?
I think the creeping tentacles of COVID are gradually suffocating it.
On that cheerful note, let's talk about another competition that's in trouble. The Women's Six Nations hasn't been a great success because there's two tiers of quality in there. We don't know if it's going to be completed now for COVID reasons. The COVID thing aside, which is this awful, unfortunate thing that's disrupted a year or more, as we all know. But the way that the teams have appeared, Steve, you watch all this closely, seems to have polarised the good teams and the less well-prepared teams even more.
Absolutely. And it's, look, there is an upside in the sense that they finally got realised that it doesn't have to be in parallel with the men's event, Owen, and they don't want it to be. They don't really need to play at midnight at Twickenham in on a freezing night in front of 400 people. They can take it away and get people like Exeter, Doncaster, maybe Saracens, and then teams in Ireland and Scotland, get them to stage it and really put on a feast of rugby in front of a good crowd. That's all good. And I think when England finally play France, if they do in this tournament, will also be good. But the awful, gut-wrenching sight of these massive victories, massive defeats, is just not doing anyone any good. The good news from the weekend is that Ireland, the good news for Ireland, looked to be a very fine side and looked like they could at least give France and England a decent game. Ireland beat Wales by a lot of points on the weekend. But as for Wales, possibly Scotland and Italy, really poor. I mean, I think people were thinking that the Ireland-Wales game on the weekend would be a real tight one, especially with the Welsh clubs or Welsh players all playing in the Premier 15s, but it was devastatingly disappointing. People said, oh, this is a discrimination. The Welsh rugby union have never helped the girls. I'm sorry, that excuse can't be used every time. It's got a certain validity, but these girls all play pro or semi-pro rugby in England, and they should have done better. So I've got a huge question mark there over the preparation of the Welsh squad, the coaching, and there is something seriously missing there.
Chris, if you were Bill Beaumont and the top man in world rugby, what would you be doing about the Women's Six Nations or the women's game to try and make it work better?
It's really sad to see this split now between the sort of the France England teams and now hopefully signs of Ireland again looking good, and this massive gap then to the next level, because there's just not number of teams out there in world rugby to keep it going in terms of really good strong fixtures against teams of equal caliber, and you're just waiting and waiting for this England France game to take place, and hopefully COVID allowing. It will do, and we'll then get a true understanding of where England are, because they look pretty fantastic, don't they? Well, also, they've got tremendous strength and depth that they've been working on. But you really want them playing against teams that push them. They're 60-point wins. I mean, they're selling the women's game because it's getting better, it's getting more exposure, playing standards are improving. But when those who have a passing interest in the sport see that sort of scoreline, it's not helping anybody. And then you throw in now that this possibility that the French might not be able to go to Dublin because of the hotel visa and all that sort of stuff. And then it just dismantles a lot of the good work that's been going on to build up the Six Nations. If I was Bill Beaumont, then I'd be looking at why the other teams outside of Ireland, France and England are performing so badly? Because, you know, they've got the money to help out, haven't they? So let's get the programmes in.
Yeah, I just wonder if they're hung up on the whole Six Nations, because that's the way it has been in the men's game. Why does it have to be six? Because they don't have Six Nations of that quality unless they bring in New Zealand and bring them into the tournament every year or something, or make it two divisions of four or something like that. I just think as it is at the moment, it's just not fit for purpose and it doesn't help anyone. The teams that are being smashed, that doesn't help them in the slightest.
I think you're right, and I would definitely look now. Let's hope that Ireland are going to be competitive. If they are, I would say from now on, England, France and Ireland play each other home and away, give you the same number of games. And then there's a second division, which the rest of the teams, plus the likes of Spain and Holland, have a second division. And there's one person promoted into the top four every year, one person relegated. And I think you'll get less massive crushing defeats. So England, France and Ireland play each other twice in the top division. The rest play each other underneath. And that's how they do it. Yeah, I think it'd be good for development as well.
There we are, Martin. You see, come on the ruck and we've just solved the problems of women's rugby in the world.
Yeah, I just think we've got to maintain faith. And I think that the rate of improvement is huge. And I think, again, to draw another parallel with the weekend, and when we saw a woman ride the winner of the Grand National this weekend, I think we can probably all remember the pieces that we saw on television X number of years ago that, if we look back, were rather patronising. Was it Charlotte Brew, who's the first woman to ride in the National? Look how quickly moved there. I think we're rather closer to where we are this weekend in National Hunt racing than the Charlotte Brew days. But I just think it goes to show, if you keep on boosting, promoting the women's game, it will come. And we're getting there, obviously, much faster with some countries than others.
Oh, I love that. And he said it in English as well. Right, okay, right. So we sign off in traditional manner with our god or goddess of the week. Chris, would you like to start us off?
I'm going to go for a deceased god of the week, because it was just really sad news yesterday here about Massimo Catito. I mean, I remember playing in Harlequins. What a lovely bloke. 70 caps, 6 years with Scotland. He was just a really nice rugby character, and reminds us of great days of Italian players and personalities. And I just want to put his name up there. It's a really sad moment. He's a victim of COVID complications and a tale of our current game, unfortunately.
Well said. Well said. Martin?
Well, I'm going to name someone who I don't think we're likely to name again this season, but he wears glasses that look as if they're being sort of carved out of the inside of a fishbowl. He's got double glazing slapped across his minces. He frequently forgets to put his teeth in, or at least that is how it appears. But Christophe Urios, to me, is the highest achieving France coach for the last decade. I mean, 10 years ago, he took Oyonnax up from Pro D2 and took them into Europe in top flight European competition. He then moved to Castres, who were in danger of relegation, won them a top 14 title. And now he's taken Bordeaux Begleur to a Champions Cup semi. There is not a French coach, I believe, in the last 10, 15 years who's achieved that with the raw materials he was given.
Very good. Jonesy?
Yeah, well, I've got one. I've got a very unlikely figure. I mean, Martin's is a bit unlikely. My unlikely god of the week is 6'11". He weighs about 6 stone. He's gangling. He has a replica Laurence Dallaglio haircut. And he emerged from obscurity, which is quite difficult when he's 6'11", to play for Leinster in the second row at Exeter. Devon Toner doesn't look like an athlete, really. He doesn't look like anything rather than a big, tall bloke with no hair. But I've always rated the bloke as a guaranteed source of lineup ball, because when you're that big and that light, it's very difficult to get anyone up so quickly and so high. And I would take him on the Lions tour to challenge Lou de Jager and Eben Etzebeth. And he was superb on the weekend, although he is. So Devon Toner, the unlikely god of the week.
Very good, boys. I was going to try and come up with an explanation for why Ronan O'Gara is the god of the week, but I'm not even going to bother. I'm going with Chris on Massimo Catita. So thanks for that one, Chris. Chris, great to have you back on again. Martin, always great to have you on again. And more of those French history lessons, please. Maybe you could do us come on and just have a little section every week with some French that we don't understand. Jonesy, lovely to see you. Everyone out there, thank you again for listening. Funnily enough, we'll be back next week. Please carry on downloading and recommending, and see you then.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.